Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely 5-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk more about cybersecurity. And today we have Tyler back on the podcast to talk with us more about AI and machine learning as it relates to cybersecurity.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers. So the first thing we wanted to talk about today was we wanted to revisit an article we talked about, I think, 3 weeks ago at this point in time, where we're talking about how China's Microsoft hack may have had a bigger purpose than just spying. And someone had been talking to NPR from the government and was hypothesizing that the government of China was pulling all this information together to feed a machine learning model. And so we have the expert, Tyler.
Oh, so that's why I'm here.
Yes. That's why Tyler's here, because he's smarter than I am and knows more about AI and machine learning. So Tyler, the Chinese apparently have all of the information for something like 80% of America's citizens. They have the clearance info from the Office of Management and Budget hack, the medical info from Anthem, credit info from Experian, travel info from Marriott, all that stuff. So what type of AI or machine learning model are they trying to train from this? And I expect you to be correct, and we'll check.
Sure. Yeah. I think they're just trying to sell you stuff, probably. There's probably nothing to fear.
It's actually Alibaba and not China.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is just to make sure we figure out what type of widgets you need. Yeah.
You know, if Amazon could actually give me what I wanted before I wanted it, that would be amazing. The promise of that is so good. And the reality is they just keep trying to feed me the romance books my wife buys on my account.
Ouch. That's funny. Well, so there's another piece of information that came out a couple years ago, some Excel file that was pulled from some data dump. And this Excel file had this extraordinary amount of information on different Americans, basically the things that would be able to poke them, different things that would make them angry or drive some sort of emotional response from a person. So certainly you could use that information for a lot of different means. You know, you talked about the clearance info, right? So we get a really great tree of background information on people who know stuff. That when I say we, geez, I'm not trying to associate myself with anybody here. But if I were the attacker, right, I'm trying to envision, obviously you get a lot of different information. So, you know, maybe you do a similar type of work as to what an adjudicator would do with that information. And you can leverage, depending on the level of information, what the adjudicator said about individual things and identify, you know, different blackmailing opportunities. But beyond that, you know, pulling just general American data, getting that credit information and medical information, you have a wide level of information around how to cluster individuals and measure those types of behaviors. And so you could leverage this information for financial gain. Right. If it's not just about, you know, let's steal information from the government, you could leverage this information for information operations. I mean, there's a whole wide variety of things. So this data is enough to not only just build clusters of behavior, but we were talking, you know, in a previous episode about the open source info you can grab from social media and what kind of damage you could do with that. This data is, you know, far worse because we know your, you know, just these credit patterns from Experian and the travel info from Marriott, we can identify, here I go saying we again, but I can identify, you know, where you are likely to go. And by the time that I run into you in a hotel bar, I know all of the things that are going to make you get angry or convert you, right? So it's a very dangerous amount of information to be able to have. And it's not just on these cleared individuals. You know, it paints a much broader picture. So if I'm just looking to gain financial leverage over individuals, I can gain that using that info.
Well, with the angry bit, that actually makes me think of, you know, that seems like a spreadsheet built for clickbait to get clicks.
Right.
because that's what gets the blood up of certain individuals.
Yeah. So if I am running an information operation and I built this network of media, what I'm trying to do is move people from one direction of thinking to another over a period of time. I can build my network of media based on my target audience, and I can identify these different behavioral patterns for these individuals. And I can even, you know, if I got travel data and credit data, I can cluster those people even better. So where it's not just this social network, it's also the physical network and geographic network of where people are traveling and likely to run into each other. And say I want to build outrage over something and cause a group of people to attack a building, I can build this network, and this network, you know, gives me a series of pieces of information that, you know, leads in a particular direction as an information operation. And then I know what will cause people to start to gain outrage. So I can start to target those people. And now, because of the level of information that I've got against those individuals, I can say with some level, you know, this 20% efficacy of, you know, grabbing these individual people in this particular region, I could posture about, you know, what are the best targets to attack, not only from just the information standpoint, but what building are we attacking or what have you. So I can drive actual real world change because of this information and this network of media and all this data that I've got. The ability to cluster all of these individuals based on these behavioral markers and these other markers gives even more strength to an operation like that.
Now, how successful do you think you'd be on the first go, though? Because it seems like you'd have to tweak your model a few times before you actually got it to where you were getting the outcomes you were expected. You know, pull this lever a little bit, tweak that one a little bit.
Well, that's why you have the people that aren't OMB people. Those are the test cases. And then you've got the cleared people that are your real targets after you've gone through a couple times and tuned your model.
Yeah, and if you're doing this in a completely automated way, you can just A/B test it. So you can just automate all these different types of testing scenarios to figure out what actually works.
Are they able with this level of detail to individually target rather than group target? Like actually send individual emails to each person that are targeted at, like how we talked last week with phishing?
Certainly, you can make it more specific. They have a ridiculous amount of data. That spreadsheet that I was talking about was individual people and what makes them tick. So they're grabbing, you know, these large scale data pieces that all are attributed back to individual users. So if you pull in an individual entity's profile of behavior, you can do this micro-targeting.
Because until like 2 years ago, you used to be able to pull everything off Facebook, right? It was just all publicly available.
Yeah, their graph API, you can just pull it all. And then what was the name of that company? Cambridge Analytica? So that I think now I've actually tried to – I was trying to build a language model off of something based off of Facebook. And it, like the number of hoops you had to jump through as a developer to be able to get access to a meaningful amount of data. It's not even a paywall situation. It's difficult to be able to get that data.
So they're just making it hard to access the API, but anybody could do it if they spent the time?
I don't know. The process was enough of a deterrent for me to go elsewhere. I didn't get deep enough.
Interesting. That's a really weak preventive measure if that's all they've got. Because anybody who's serious will put in the time.
Well, you know, if you create a business and they have some level of know your customer around what the business is doing or what the application's being developed for. And then there's some sort of, I'm pretty sure, a review process where someone goes through and says, okay, this is an acceptable use of this application. And then once you have that, you're able to query against the API. I mean, there are some levels of rigor applied to that.
Okay.
But I think it used to be you could pull in any form of demographic data, you know, that you wanted to and query about the graph of information. I think that is the capability of querying from an external standpoint is much lower now, even if you go through those hoops.
You know, one question I had that Matt and I talked about at the time we went over this article that hopefully maybe you can provide some better insight on is what's the benefit of What would be the benefit of using this data on American citizens versus, and the article was talking about using it to train their AI, and that you needed large data sets in order to train the AI. And I'm just wondering, what's the value of using this on 80% of Americans, which I think you said was, what, 260-something million,
Matt? Something like that.
Versus probably a much more accurate and full data set of 1 billion Chinese.
I mean, they're probably doing that too, right?
Yeah, but it's completely different. Our culture is completely different. The level of of utilization of these network applications is different. The behaviors are very, very different. So,
but the data sets are the same, whether you're talking about medical data or credit data or travel data. They're still the same basic functions because they're people, just like Americans are people. So it seems like the data sets that they were talking about could be equivalent without having the nuances of, you know, this guy likes red shirts versus plaid shirts or whatever.
You know, I have to wonder, I would not be surprised if China was doing both, and they were doing both with two different aims, one over control and one over, well, control, but a different type of control.
Right.
Well, there's the internal process where, as a state-run entity, they have like this social credit score and all these like really ridiculously authoritarian oversteps that they use this internal data for. And they've got this, you know, state-run democracy where they own, you know, the operating companies, right? But to use that internally for authoritarian means is very different than trying to gain information on other external countries, and what you're able to do with that data, I think, is fundamentally different. So, I mean, just purely having it segmented, I don't think that they're necessarily using that data to drive their authoritarian outcomes. I think they're using it for state-sponsored outcomes that are external.
Well, maybe I said it incorrectly, or I wasn't clear in the way that I was phrasing the question. And this was my understanding from, or what I could recall from reading the article, was that what they were hypothesizing was that they were using this data set to train the AI, to improve the AI. And I'm wondering if you're just using it for that and not getting particular outcomes to leverage attacks or do things like that, simply to improve the AI, would not the data on the Chinese be a better tool to improve the AI versus imperfect data from the American side? Does that make more sense, or is that a better question?
You know, I think it comes back to, what are you looking to leverage this algorithm for? If you're looking to leverage this algorithm for authoritarian means within your own internal walls, then I don't necessarily see the impact being very large from garnering from outside. I don't know why you would lead some large-scale espionage attack against another country to try to improve your own internal authoritarian data, because you already have access to all of it through all of the companies that you have large stakes inside of. For espionage purposes, that it makes sense to have this. So building their own AI, I don't think is like, I think there's a very hard line between the espionage that and the types of attacks that they're going to be able to build use cases off of from this data or these models versus what they are using it for at home.
Okay, so to translate what I think you just said was that the AI that you would use for internal security would be different than the AI you would use for external security, different algorithms, different models. So switching those data sets around, it doesn't provide value. Okay.
Right. And I mean, there's probably some cross-pollination or some value between the two. Like, if you want to determine that any of your citizens are acting more Western-like, and so you're going to say, oh, well, run a classifier against the two, maybe there's some crossover there. But I would think that you would probably just do that mostly with your internal data.
Wearing blue jeans and listening to rock and roll music. You're like, oh, it's too Western.
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting. You think that China is using AI and machine learning to help keep track of internal users? Is that built into the social credit score?
Yeah, absolutely. They have all this camera data, credit data, all of these, you know, individual markers of what humans are doing, and that, you know, their 1.6 billion citizens are doing. And so they're leveraging this at scale. I saw something where, you know, if a person jaywalks across the street, you know, the camera captures it, it will socially shame that person. And there will be a billboard up that says this person jaywalked, and other, basically other users are incentivized to say you're a bad person for what you've done. So yeah, that they are.
Well, that would depend on the person, because me, I'd get a t-shirt printed up with that picture on it that showed me jaywalking.
Now, I knew they had people reporting their neighbors, and like they had, you know, people in each neighborhood who would report on their neighbors. I didn't realize that they'd rolled the AI stuff in too. But that makes sense. Otherwise, there's no realistic way to keep track of 1.6 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that we thought might be worth talking about, and this is mostly my own idiocy, specific detections using machine language. So we've talked before, we had a couple episodes talking about AI and machine language. We talked about, you know, training models, supervised versus unsupervised training, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought I might talk a little more in detail about how machine learning can be used to detect things like phishing attacks, network attacks, malicious logins. Are these all kind of the same thing to the machine learning, or are these separate training, separate algorithms?
Well, all of them are going to be, you know, very different, and there's different ways to go about doing these sorts of detections. Right. So, you know, we talked before about supervised versus unsupervised learning. Supervised learning could be pretty effective in determining phishing if you had this large data set of prior phishing attacks. But then, you know, we talked about in a previous discussion, you know, the ability to leverage a language model like GPT-3 to hyper tailor spear phishing to individuals for impact. May be less impactful because we don't have a data set around that. So there's this trade-off between the generalizability and the accuracy of the model.
Yeah. Speaking on the phishing attacks, I know looking at that presentation they gave, they found that you could also use machine learning to detect AI-generated spear phishing attacks, looking at the distribution of how often words were used. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny outcome. Because, you know, these models, basically the way that a language model works is, well, not all of them, but a lot of these are going to say, well, I have this current word. What's the probability of this next word that comes in the sequence to develop a total, you know, thought or sentence? And so if it's just running some probability distribution about what the next word would be, you're definitely going to run into that where there's low variance with the words that are used overall. So yeah, you do run into that. That's an interesting.
Is that something
heuristic
that's generalizable for, like, if there was a AI that was trained to use Metasploit or something, where you could see the order of the attacks maybe, or the timing, and then look at it and be like, oh, this is an AI doing this versus a human.
Certainly. But you, if you're a practitioner developing this red team, you can also develop like a curiosity score that says, hey, from time to time, you're going to, with, you know, some parameter, going to explore different opportunities or options, or you're going to wait. So, you know, part of, I think I did a beaconing detection like 4 years ago. It was looking for, you know, the same IP being hit with very low variance between the number of seconds. Right. And so how do you adapt to that? Well, you have some pseudo random, beaconing activity, right? So there's always a way to get around some of those things. If you build in a language model like GPT-3 that, you know, maybe it does have this distribution of words that are coming up. You have this generator that's generating the text, and you have a discriminator that's trying to determine whether or not this is, you know, created by a language model. Then eventually you can learn about how you cannot get detected.
So we're running into a situation where we're going to have AI on the offense and defensive side, and it's going to be tic-tac-toe.
Exactly. But with tic-tac-toe, there's a deterministic way to have it always end in a tie. So that's the best case scenario.
And the role of the humans is only going to be to explain to the CEO what happened.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of the other issues, you know, we talked before about supervised learning, this lack of explainability. If you have a model with 175 billion parameters, well, probably smaller amount than that. But if you have a model with some large number of parameters, how do you explain to a human? How do you show this to you or David or even me and say, hey, this is why we detected this? A lot of those models are not very good at describing that.
Sock puppets.
Exactly. You need an effective dashboard that shows with sock puppets why this alerted. And so, you know, in the phishing space, one of the ways I think about detections just in general is there's different heuristics that we can pull in. So maybe one of them is this language model that looks for a sense of urgency or sense, you know, to take action. It also looks for a link that's inside of there. It's embedded into the email or a document, right? Maybe that document gets scanned and has some sort of confidence score about whether it was relevant or not. Or if it had something potentially malicious in it. If you add enough of these heuristics together, you can generate some sort of anomaly score for the or outlier score for this particular thing, or a confidence interval about whether this is bad or not. And so, because instead of saying I'm going to look at, you know, 100 million parameters, I'm actually looking at very specific heuristics when it comes time to explain why I detected this particular thing, I can explain it very clearly. It had these markers that looked bad. So human, these are the sock puppet. This is the sock puppet moment. Take a look at these individual things. In the document, we saw this text string that looks incredibly weird, and we think you should look at it. Oh, and by the way, it comes from a spoofed domain. These two markers are why I think this is a phishing attack.
You know, it's going to be interesting. We're going to have an AI that is just like that guy in Office Space whose job is to talk to the engineers and then go talk to the managers and translate between them.
Well, that's what I was just thinking was, you know, is this an opportunity for someone to develop basically that human interface translation between the outcome and what a human can understand, and for vendors to subscribe to that? Or is this something that only the vendors themselves who create these things can produce a translation that people can understand?
If you're the vendor and you're creating the tool itself and all, and you know what goes into it, I think you're uniquely positioned to do a better job. And if you're collecting data from the field, you're uniquely positioned to do a better job, right? If you're Microsoft and you handle Azure Active Directory, you are uniquely positioned with your data and the fact that you structured, you know, this entire infrastructure to make really solid detection techniques.
You would think so.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of IDS stuff already has that problem where it tells you something's bad, but it doesn't tell you any of the supporting data behind it or how it made the decision or what the signature is.
Yeah, don't even get me started on some of those IDS systems. Yeah. They give the most useless information.
Yeah, this is bad. Trust me.
Exactly. Yeah, and so are these other 175,000 things today, by the way.
So it's almost they're at conflict with each other, saying, you know, they're in the best position to actually give you something that's meaningful and understandable, and yet they don't because of reasons.
Well, I think that some tools do a good job and others don't. And I think it's not necessarily a moving target, but there's always some form of progress. And we got to cut the vendors that don't do a good enough job over a period of time.
All right. You had specifically mentioned when we discussed before the podcast about detecting supply chain attacks via machine learning. And those are all in the news with SolarWinds and Kaseya and other attacks. So tell me more. Tell me how we're going to solve this problem with AI.
Oh, well, you're going to solve it with blockchain. it's going to be hard to get a company like SolarWinds to obviously release their data, because there's all, it becomes a problem of attack surface with it, if they release all that data to all of the vendors or everyone who uses them as a vendor. And so there's some nominal part of the problem that you're not going to be able to manage, right? That's just known. And a lot of spaces in the kill chain, it's hard to create a high quality detection at these earlier stages. And sometimes it's not feasible to create a detection at the earlier phases just because of the false positive rates. But there still is an attack chain, and you can leverage these early phase detections and kind of mold them together into a chain of activity. So while we're not necessarily, unless I'm SolarWinds and their development team, going to detect that there's been a change to the core code of the product and this got through under the radar, if I'm a company that uses the product, what I might be able to do is say, okay, well, the process tree has changed. There's a new order of processes, or a new process that started, or a parent-child process relationship that's strange. And that's in and of itself not a high-quality detection, but it is a weak signal that can be pointed to in a larger model. So, some sort of process change happened. And it, depending on the product, maybe there's different profiles of behavior. Some products don't change very often, some do a lot. And so maybe that's one of my features. And then we've got some meaningful change in the activity of accounts, what sorts of activities they're taking. And so you can pull in these other forms of metadata. And once again, on their own, not a high quality detection. They really don't tell you anything. And I would never be able to say, hey, analysts, look at this, because I can explain it to you with sock puppets. I'm not going to be able to show it to you because, you know, I'd be showing you 2,000 of these a day. But when you think about the risk-based analytics concepts, where we are logging risk relative to these events, you can say, okay, well, we had this rare process change that happened after a software update took place. Then we have this other activity related to reaching out to an uncommon domain, followed by these other things. And because we're tracking risk, all of these are small different signatures, but they're sort of pushing this activity outside of the realm of normal. And you can establish a lower bound of some sort of perimeter upon which, when things are sufficiently weird enough, we need to detect on it. And if that activity goes from those core things I was talking about and then turns into this privilege escalation and lateral movement activity that maps to espionage, you can search through the graph to identify that all of this started from these core risk objects that I made in the first place. And so when you set that parameter that says start firing at this threshold of rareness of activity or anomalous level of activity based on those risk metrics, you can identify a supply chain attack, hopefully left of impact, or further left than when Mandiant comes out and says, oh, hey, by the way, there's this thing that's been going on for 9 months.
So it sounds like we could really do all this today, really, but I don't think the data points that you're talking about are really being collected, though, because I think if we took those and threw them into the sim, we could, without, too much ML, really use a risk-based alerting model to bring those to the front for the SOC to investigate.
Well, this actual, I'm speaking at Splunk Conf this year, and it's actually on this type of topic. It's not on supply chain specifically, but this model of advancing risk-based analytics to being more dynamic. And this concept of throwing in a bunch of different weak signatures and creating some sort of dynamic risk model to identify what's weird in an environment. So I think that you can, but when you run into like those earlier stages, I was talking about process monitoring. A lot of times with the SIEM tools that charge based on the amount of data you ingest, it can be difficult to get all of the levels of data that you want. And so maybe you have another tool that offers some metadata that says, oh, well, I scanned these process trees and I found something that's weird and it fires at some given rate on, you know, this particular host or these applications. So you can, you know, take that metadata and still do something with it, like a carbon black, right? Maybe provide some of that metadata that you want, or you make a specific signature detection inside of there. So you're not grabbing all of that information and then logging it into the SIEM, but you're grabbing some metadata about it. And, you know, with the authentication information or, you know, Active Directory information or any of those other cloud services, you can still grab a lot of those pieces, you know. So I think that you can grab a lot of it in the SIEM, but you may have to do it at the security appliance level for some of them just based on data volume.
Yeah, thinking about what you're talking about, all that stuff seems collected in an EDR now, or mm-hmm. you know, with Microsoft Sysmon or something. You just have to be, you're looking at it in a new way, in a new way.
Yeah. And so imagine like something that, you know, analyzes these process trees and you've developed just an additional, maybe your EDR doesn't have something that looks at this probabilistically, but it profiles your user specific behavior in your specific environment with this endpoint running these applications. And maybe you have a server class that says, you know, these 10,000 servers are going to be expected to run the same way. These five are going to be different. And it builds some sort of probabilistic tree of what happens. And over time, things change, right? It's constantly going to be moving, but the profiles are online learning constantly. And it's some agent that's placed on every single endpoint that's monitoring for these things. When there is a sufficient enough outlier to draw a risk object out, then it sends something via the forwarder into the SIEM. So I think there's definitely some ability to grab that data without having to log everything where it can just do that locally.
Yeah. What's the requirement for storage to accurately detect something like that? I mean, you have to keep all that process information, all the DNS requests and everything for months at least. It's maybe a pretty stiff requirement for that level of detail.
Yeah, so I think you can do it with relatively normalized data that allows it to be very efficient. I focus on online learning, so we're trying to just store the absolute minimum amount of information. So all of our historical data, say we have a 90-day baseline, we pull in count data or descriptive statistics or you know, just this outside metadata that represents the overall structure. And maybe you have to prune it in certain places. For example, you can only pull in, you know, because this is a large tree, we can only pull in the top 1,000 largest pieces from this because it's an N squared storage problem. So if we can only pull in the top 1,000 most common, then we've got prior data on potentially a million different rows or columns, whatever, mm-hmm. of information that we retain count volume on. But then when things start, but we're able to also say, okay, well, given this N squared storage that we keep locally on each agent or network-wide, we keep this information, then we can look at changes of behavior as it maps to like an entropy score or some probability score. And, you know, I'm only retaining this amount of information, but if this is starting to change above and beyond and a lot of things outside of that top 1,000 start to show up, then I will ascribe risk to it. And so you can do it efficiently via the metadata pieces.
Metadata, how would sampling affect this? I know, for example, Splunk has, you know, like a 1 in 10, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000 sampling rates available for the really big searches. I mean, I guess that'd probably be a real mistake if this is a super rare thing that only happens one time, because sampling 1 in 10, you're going to miss it 90% of the time.
Well, I never actually use, like in the Splunk, I never use the sampling unless, and it, because you're almost certainly going to miss the thing that you want. Like you want to be deterministic about being able to find the problem, right? So just taking the sampling could be useful for maybe building a model. What I was talking about before, where it's like, okay, well, maybe we're pruning stuff smartly. So I know that these 1,000 parent processes have potentially 1,000 children. Then I can keep, you know, that level of information. And as time goes on, maybe I can prune slightly differently. So when changes happen and something needs to be moved into that top 1,000, I know what to kick out of the bottom. But it's really keeping the most relevant information at the top. And I don't think that's applicable in all cases. Like one of the things I developed was try to find when a user is trying to find what files they have access to, just trying to push as far as they can into their access for files. And so there's this data that you have to keep. This particular user on this particular host with this particular file path with this particular file at the end. And that becomes a very large data problem if you look at all data that a user could potentially explore in an environment multiplied by the number of users that are there, right? That is huge. But in reality, a user is really only looking at the same files over and over and over again. So maybe over a 90-day period, they touch a total of 3,000 different files. And maybe you know to exclude temp files from those, or specific directories from them. So you can smartly go about pruning the data that comes in that you store.
Gotcha. Yeah, because that's what everybody's worried about, right? Is how much data are we storing? Since so many of the SIEMs mm-hmm. charge based on input.
But yeah, the way that I go about doing it is I have an external VM that queries the REST endpoint for the SIEM to pull out data. So it's doing data storage locally. So it's not being re-ingested into the SIEM. It's taking advantage of the data that's in the SIEM, pulls it out, creates the metadata, stores it, and then runs inference to determine whether something's an outlier or not and needs to develop a risk object with some dynamic risk score. And the only thing that goes back into the SIEM ever is the dynamic risk score object when it's sufficiently high enough to fire.
So you decrease your volume of SIEM storage, but you increase your external storage volume for this VM then.
Exactly. But it is relatively nominal. Because by the time that you're getting it into the SIEM, it's been normalized to some extent. And and when you're pulling it out, it's normalized to just count, and it's been pruned in a particular way. So it's not like if you're querying a terabyte of data a day, you're going to be storing a terabyte a day. It's more like you're querying a terabyte a day, and you might be increasing your storage size by a megabyte or smaller.
So it would be like, you know, you pull a terabyte into the SIEM. This external system would analyze it and then discard everything but the metadata, kind of?
Yeah. So layer one is, so you have to have a build of the data. One of the things I hate about a lot of UBA products is they're like, we got to run in your system for 30 days before you can provide anything meaningful. Meanwhile, it's running on a SIEM and you have all of the data for the last 30 days there. So why... Anyways, I think that's like so dumb. Like all of the data is there. Why can't you just pull it right now? But so the first layer is you have to build. You have to you pull all of the historical data up to whatever your time horizon is and build your initial metadata. Then the next steps are you query the most recent time segment of whatever your horizon is. So maybe it's 15 minutes, maybe it's 5 minutes. Like you created a cron schedule that runs every 5 minutes. It pulls, 5 minutes of data and it allows the SIEM to perform indexing. So maybe it's like 10 minutes ago to 5 minutes ago. And it pulls just that time window of data. And so it takes that out and then it processes it to pull out basically the count data or what type of information we're trying to keep. And then it will update the existing built baseline when you need to. But right now it's pulling it so that you can run inference. So we have our entire baseline of user activity. We're going to look at all of our prior activity for each individual row and determine if there's some level of risk associated with these particular activities. And if that level of dynamic risk is above the threshold to send something to the risk index, we're going to output it back into the SIEM into to the summary index for risk. But then we're going to keep that data for just a couple more minutes in memory, and we're going to update the existing build. So now, if our original build was on 90 days, now we have 90 days plus 5 minutes of data. And so it's just updating the initial counts, which may not materially increase the actual data storage required at all, because you have a 90-day window of already historical data. You're just increasing count values for those in your internal database. And so all you ever need to do is query the X minute of most recent data at any given time. And then once enough time has passed, in order to make sure that the process can keep up with the system, you have to kill the existing DB and do an initial build. And maybe that's every 30 days or 60 days or what have you. But at some time horizon, you want to kick off a rebuild and, you know, scan through the most recent set of data.
So I just want to get one point of clarification on this. And so it sounds like what you're talking about, Tyler, using this external system and the SIM together is actually a way to vastly improve your outcomes while reducing your costs as far as what data you're putting in and retaining in the SIM then. So this could be a relatively large overall benefit for cost for storage and licensing, possibly for SIM and IR in general for monitoring, if I'm understanding you correctly anyway.
Yeah, there's significant outcomes from doing stuff this way. So, you know, we can talk all day about the efficacies of this style of detection versus others, but this type of metadata collection and behavioral understanding allows you to actually access data from the SIM more efficiently. And maybe in the future, you don't have to go through the SIM to get that sort of data. Maybe these EDRs just use this type of methodology, and there's just an algorithm on the SIM that takes the metadata to process the information. Or maybe there's not necessarily a SIM in the first place. Who knows XDR. What that future looks like. Exactly. That sort of process reduces the number of alerts that are seen, certainly, because it's that risk-based analytics. It's just slightly more dynamic and more explainable, because I can show an analyst a swim lane of all these different, you know, past, you know, things that have happened that are mapped back to this user or entity. So, yeah, the SIM is really only carrying this small pieces of metadata in the best case scenario, and we're tuning it to constantly reduce. If the cost of the SIM is purely based on how much data I'm storing, well, I'm going to optimize that and reduce it as much as possible while still meaningfully, you know, running these detections.
It sounds like Tyler has actually killed the SIM right here on this podcast.
Well, you know, one of the other reasons that I developed it this way was because, you know, I could do all of this inside of the SIM. It doesn't necessarily have to step outside. Originally, what this was a container that runs on the SIM. The SIM outputs some data, or we query against it via its API, and then it stores data locally that just is able to be queried locally. But we wanted this to be completely separated from the SIM so that it could also query additional data sources. So I work in insider threat for some of my work, and you want to be able to query an HR database, but you're not going to put that data inside of the SIM. So you want to be able to say any data source to some sort of alerting mechanism that needs to have some level of custodial ownership of the data that can't necessarily cross paths. So this system actually needs to sit outside of the SIM because you're not going to put all the data in there.
Well, that sounds like a good place to stop for the night.
Well, thanks for having me on, guys.
No, we're always happy to have smarter people than us on. That's why I brought David on the podcast originally.
Yeah, he couldn't get any kindergartners.
Oh my goodness. Thank you for coming on, Tyler. It's been a great conversation. And thanks to all of you out there for listening to the Security Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SerengetiSec. Download and listen from your favorite podcast application, and keep your spirit sharp. If you have a better outro, please let me know.